Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak about the spike of refugee children at our border with Todd Miller. Todd is the author of a new book called Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. And we're also going to talk about the massive buildup of security at the border. We've militarized the border, despite what you may hear about the federal government refusing to enforce the law. Then we're going to talk about what's going on in Gaza with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute of Policy Studies. You know, we covered both of these stories last week, but we have different guests looking at some different angles. There are also, you know, two of the three big stories this week, along with the downing of a Malaysian airliner over Ukraine. It hasn't been a good year for Malaysian Airways, and that story is just so awful. There were over 100 AIDS researchers on board heading for a conference on HIV prevention. There were three babies on board, and there are reports that bodies were literally raining out of the sky. Anyway, on a lighter note, here are a few stories you may have missed this week. There is a woman who is about to graduate from school as a nurse practitioner. She wants to work in a women's health clinic, and she applied for a job at a federally funded healthcare clinic in Tampa. Now, during an exchange with the HR director, an email exchange, she says, "Hey, by the way, I'm a religious conservative, so I can't prescribe some forms of birth control that I believe, and I want to stress the word believe, cause abortions." Now, scientists agree they don't cause abortions, but that's her religious belief. So the clinic is like, "Well, yeah, sorry, but prescribing contraceptives is actually part of this job. So, you know, best of luck in your future endeavors." Now, you know what's coming next, right? The Alliance Defending Freedom, which you may recall co-authored Arizona's Freedom to Discriminate Against Gays and Lesbians bill, which crashed and burned earlier this year, jumped in and sued for religious discrimination. This is where we're at in 2014. This isn't a clinic that performs abortion, right? It's just birth control, which, I don't know, 99% of women have used at one point or another. And this woman wants to work there as a nurse, but can't do the job. She can't do the job. And this is religious discrimination? I mean, can you imagine someone applying to be a bus driver and saying, "Well, my religion doesn't allow me to drive, but just because I can't drive a bus, you have no right to discriminate against me by not hiring me to drive a bus." I mean, it's so crazy. The Discovery Channel is in deep water this week, pun intended. The network started a scare in Canada with a hoax video that went viral, supposedly showing a bull shark on the loose in Lake Ontario. People freaked out. They kept their kids from swimming. But it turns out to just be a promotional stunt for the network's Shark Week series. I probably shouldn't even mention this story. I'm giving them the publicity that they crave. Never mind, I said anything. In Michigan, Terry Lynn Land is running for an open Senate seat. She's a Republican. It's a tight race. She has a lot of money, and she gave her campaign $3 million. Nothing wrong with that, except for the fact that she'd listed her assets as being worth half that amount on a financial disclosure form. She said, "Yeah, I got $1.5 million. Oops. So Land says it's all a big mistake. She'd forgotten about that account with millions of dollars in it that was controlled jointly between Land and her husband. As Nick Bauman from Mother Jones put it, Land claims she forgot about an account she had with an enormous amount of money in it, even as she was using that money to fund her campaign. Land, I should point out, was Secretary of State from 2003 through 2011, and among her duties was enforcing the state's campaign finance laws. Anyway, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Todd Miller. I got some bad news this morning, which in turn made my day. When this someone spoke, I listened. All of a sudden has less and less to say. All this time I've lived vicariously. Who's gonna save my soul now?
like somebody. Like somebody else. Although he was imitated often, it felt like I was being myself. It is a shame that someone else's song was totally and completely dependent on. Who's gonna save my soul? Was it possible you were hurting worse than me? Still my hunger turns to greed. Cause what about what I need? Oh, who's gonna save my soul?
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland. You know, we're hearing a lot these days from conservatives about how these refugee children on our border are infested with diseases. And that is just such a dirty lie. According to the New York Times, a shelter for Central American children at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio has seen, out of thousands of children, 133 cases of head lice, 25 cases of scabies, 15 cases of chickenpox, and one case of the flu. And a spokeswoman running the shelter said, and I quote, "The illnesses that we're seeing at these sites are not unlike what public school nurses see. We do not believe these children present any public health concern." The Texas Observer reports, children from Guatemala, where vaccines are provided free of charge by the government's universal health care system, are more likely to be vaccinated against various diseases than children in Texas, where the rate of parents who opt out of vaccinations, citing reasons of conscience, has increased every year. This is not a new dirty lie. In 2009, Michelle Malkin blamed Mexican immigrants, undocumented immigrants, for swine flu. In 2007, Lou Dobbs said that undocumented immigrants are bringing leprosy to America. What makes this so stupid is the idea that there's some relationship between disease and whether one has valid papers. After all, every day, hundreds of thousands of people travel between the U.S. and Mexico and other countries in Latin America on business and for vacation. Germs don't care if you've got papers or not. And all of this kind of reminds me of the Middle Ages when people blamed the Jews for the plague. They said, oh, the Jews must be poisoning the wells. This is just the modern version. Anyway, I'm joined now by Todd Miller. Todd is a journalist, and he authored a new book titled Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I'm always honest when I haven't had a chance to read a book. Yours is two away on my list. I didn't want to wait weeks to have you on, given what's happening at the southern border. And the reason I'm honest is because when I wrote a book, sometimes I'd be doing an interview, and about halfway through, you'd be like, this guy has not read my book. He's faking it. I can tell he's faking it. All right. So everyone across the political spectrum describes what's happening right now on the border as a crisis. A crisis is, according to my dictionary, a time of intense difficulty, trouble, or danger. Is the arrival of around 1/1000th of the world's refugee population on our border a crisis, or is it a crisis of our own making through a policy that stresses border security over other aspects of immigration control?
Well, Oh, that is the question of the day. That is a great question. I would say, in terms of thinking about things through the vantage point of what we're talking about, what is 52,000 children that have arrived to our borders, to our southern borders since October 1st on the fiscal year 2014. In their eyes, it's definitely, you know, a crisis because hearing the stories and the situations, a lot of these kids are fleeing is one, you know, that fits the description of the definition of a crisis that you just read. So in the children's eyes, it is definitely a crisis, and it's a crisis so much so you have to look at it in terms of response and how to respond to it. On one level, they should be considered refugees and treated as such. On the second level, and the second layer of the question you asked, I would say a lot of this has to do with U.S. policy. The U.S. policy on many different levels, and one of them is, you know, like right now, in the debates around the subject, and the debate is really hot there in Congress. You're hearing all this talk about, for one, border security. The idea that the border is quote unquote porous. That there's one union rep from the Border Patrol who said it's more porous than it's ever been. And you know, quote unquote, that's a paraphrase. And you hear this on and on and on and on. And the truth of the matter is, the border buildup, what we're seeing on the U.S.-Mexico border and on the northern border, for that matter, is a buildup, a regime, a border enforcement regime that of the size that we've never seen before in the history of the United States. There's been tons of resources put into this since the mid 1990s, particularly with operations like Operation Gatekeeper, and then in the post 9/11 era. You saw, you know, Border Patrol agents go from 4,000 in the early 1990s, and to put that in perspective, Border Patrol was formed in 1924. So to put that even more perspective, you went from 1776 to 1924 with no Border Patrol. But when it started, it was it was about 500 agents, and it was a very slow growing agency up until the early 1990s when it became 4,000 agents. So what we see now with 23,000 agents. Is in a literal, it's five times the size it was in the early 1990s. And on top of that, it's part of Customs and Border Protection, which did not exist in the pre-9/11 era. It's a Department of Homeland Security agency. Border Patrol is under that. That is about 65,000 agents. That includes an Air and Marine division, pretty much like an Air Force and a Navy almost. With 1,200 agents working in that alone, and it's double the size of Ecuador's army. You could look at it that way. We could look at what we're seeing on the borders almost like the creation of a domestic army. And so when you hear people talking right now saying there's nothing on the border, it's ludicrous. There's more than we've ever seen before. The budgets are for, like, if you just take the federal budgets for, if you look fiscal year 2012, the federal budget for immigration and border enforcement was $18 billion, and that was more than all other federal law enforcement agencies combined. And that's the combined FBI, the DEA, the U.S. Marshals, and some others, their combined budgets were $14.4 billion. So it's definitely, the United States is putting a priority on border security, this idea, this notion of building, putting walls, putting all kinds of technologies, hiring all kinds of agents to like stand on the border, to they call it, and using the rhetoric like the defense, you know, and defense, you know, what is it, the front lines of Homeland Security, the front lines of the country, with this sort of language that's almost a militaristic posturing, implying that we're at war with someone, we're at war with are we at war with Mexico? I didn't think so. I thought we were friendly with Mexico, but you would think that with the kind of rhetoric that's being used.
And you also hear the rhetoric of invasion, a lot of invasion stuff. Exactly. I'm always gobsmacked by people who say we just need to secure the border. It seems that they're just completely oblivious to the degree to which we've militarized not only the border, but this whole zone surrounding the border.
Exactly. Yeah. When you think about the idea that the border is the boundary, you know, the just the thin line, the boundary line between a country, and I'm sure a lot of people, you know, just would think that when you think of the border. Probably some people think of the 18-foot walls, or you know, the kind of quintessential symbolic look of the U.S.-Mexico border, but the border zone actually is 100 miles inland. So from the international boundary line, say I live in Tucson, I live 60 miles away from the international boundary line. I am very much in the middle of what Border Patrol's jurisdiction. And so the border stuff, there's stuff that's put right on the border, but this kind of enforcement mechanism goes 100 miles back. So there's all kinds of like surveillance towers with high-powered cameras and infrared cameras and radar and all kinds of operational control rooms, or what they call war rooms, where with video walls where agents can scan the landscape. There's unmanned aerial vehicles or drones, surveillance drones that could literally can patrol in, you know, 100 miles into the United States. So if you think of the Southwest, they could be flying over Tucson, they could be flying over San Diego, El Paso. You know, what are they doing flying over here? You know, it raises all kinds of questions. And this jurisdiction's also in the north. So 100 miles to the south.
My father and I were driving through Texas last year or the year before. We were stopped at two checkpoints, and, you know, is the classic kind of papers, please. You wrote a piece for Tom Dispatch recently where you referenced this constitution-free zone. You said 66% of Americans live in this zone. Can you explain that for my audience?
Yeah, sure. It's along those lines of the jurisdiction is from the international boundary line 100 miles in. So I'll ask your listeners to imagine the United States, the shape of the United States, the contours of its border. So the 2,000-mile-long one with Mexico, up the coast, because the border is the coast as well, like the west coast, go up the 4,000-mile-long border with Canada, and then down the east coast. And imagine a thick band, which encompasses 100 miles, going all around the country. What you're seeing is that is what Border Patrol's jurisdiction is. It's if you look at this band, it literally devours whole states. Like the whole state of Florida is completely within a Border Patrol jurisdiction. The whole state of Maine is completely within Border Patrol jurisdiction. And so checkpoints, like you just mentioned, can be installed in these places. Transportation checks, which happen in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with regularity, where Border Patrol agents get on local Greyhound buses or on Amtrak trains, and they ask people for their papers, or they, you know, if they suspect, they're kind of like a national security police with a counterterrorism mission. So if they suspect any sort of national security issue, they can pull people off and question them. You know, this sort of what ACLU calls a constitution-free zone is, and if you look at it, it's covering like many major cities in the United States. So it is about 66% of the population. Two-thirds of the population are 200 million people. And one point to make. There are many places within this jurisdiction that you are not seeing Border Patrol. For example, in North Carolina, on the North Carolina coast, you're not necessarily seeing them there. You're not seeing them in, you know, if they're not throughout this whole jurisdiction. However, in discussing the expansion of the Border Patrol that we were discussing earlier, they are appearing in places where nobody's ever seen them before, like Erie, Pennsylvania, like Rochester, New York. Like places like that where all of a sudden locals are, what, a checkpoint? You know, the classic checkpoint story of Senior Senator Patrick Leahy, who was who was, he said he was 125 miles south of the border in New York State. He was traveling in his car with a Vermont license plate that said senator on it, or U.S. government or something. And he pulled up to a Border Patrol checkpoint, and the Border Patrol agent said, asked him to get out of his car, and then Leahy asked, under whose authority? And the Border Patrol agent pointed to a gun and said, that's all the authority I need. And that's what Leahy testified to Congress. That's what he reported. So that's the kind of thing that we're talking about in 100 miles.
Now, you mentioned that we've increased spending on border security exponentially, and that's literally exponentially, because I believe in the mid-90s we're spending about $700 million a year on border security, and that's up to, I think you mentioned, close to $20 billion now.
Right.
And that began really in Clinton's second term. It continued essentially unabated through today. Congress is talking about increasing border security yet more. Has it had any impact on immigration flows?
Yeah, so what's happened with the border security plan, it's been this idea that it's called a prevention by deterrence. So what the Border Patrol strategy has been to build up their resources, concentrate their agents, put the walls, put all the technology in urban areas. And this started in the 1990s, actually. And the idea was that these are traditional crossing places for people crossing border crossers, undocumented border crossers. So the idea was if they were stopped in these traditional places, that other places such as the desert in Arizona, right south of here, would serve as a natural barrier, that it would be too dangerous, too desolate, too deadly for people to actually dare to cross. These sorts of policies were put in place, and I would argue that the same policies in place have just expanded significantly. So what has happened is that, first of all, when these policies were put in place in the NAFTA era, or when NAFTA was implemented, the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico, so 1993, 1994, 1995, 1996. So what we saw from Mexico was unprecedented immigration. A historic number of Mexicans were immigrating from Mexico to the United States in the years following, like the late 1990s, up until around 2006, 2007. And what was happening was that with the Mexican migration, that they would hit these high enforcement areas, but they would funnel around them. So they call it the funnel effect, or the balloon effect, this idea that the immigration flows went around the enforcement areas and went into these dangerous and desolate areas. So people end up walking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, sometimes 12. I interviewed a woman that was in the desert for 26 days, often without enough water, often without enough food. But they still are making the journey. And you can look at the statistics since the 1990s. There's been 6,000 remains of border crossers found in the desert lands, the borderlands on the U.S.-Mexico border, and those are just the remains found. So but what happened in around late 2000s, around 2008, 2009, is that we started seeing a decrease in immigration, in looking at Border Patrol arrests, there was less and less. A lot of CBP people would step up to the mic and say, hey, look, our border security plan is working, there's probably some truth in it because it is more and more and more difficult for people to cross. But then again, you have Janet Napolitano, the former DHS chief, who said, show me a 50-foot ladder and I'll show you a 51-foot, or show me a 50-foot wall and I'll show you a 51-foot ladder. So you have even DHS people saying, if people are going to come, they're going to come no matter what. That's kind of the rhetoric, the idea that this border, our border enforcement buildup, our fortification of the border has impeded people from coming. But it also coincides with less jobs, the recession, all kinds of stuff that if there's not jobs to be had in the United States, then less people will come. So And now, like as you're mentioning, that's the idea again, and that's it's almost ludicrous in the situation that we have now with the children who are basically coming across, or even just going to the ports of entry and turning themselves in. They're actually turning themselves in to the Border Patrol. So the idea that not all of them are, but a good percentage of them are turning themselves in. So the idea that we have to get more Border Patrol agents, that we have to put up more fences, that we have to get more drones, this constant like push for more and more stuff on the border seems just ridiculous considering the situation.
It's truly been an exercise in futility, and I just want to drive this point home to the listeners. We started this huge ramp up in the mid-90s at the same time as we signed NAFTA, which flooded Latin America, especially Mexico, with deeply subsidized corn, wiped out agricultural employment. In the years between that and about 2007, while we were spending more and more and more money on border security, we saw ever-increasing flows of migrants from Latin America, and that only started to decrease when our financial system crashed and there wasn't the pull factor of jobs in play anymore to the same degree. Now, we've seen a bunch of high-dollar boondoggles on the border. We gave a big pile of money to Boeing, a defense contractor, to build this so-called virtual fence along the southern border. It never functioned. There is talk now of reviving the project. Tell me about the military-industrial immigration complex.
Yeah, that is... The multi-billion-dollar contract that went to Boeing, there are actually some of the towers that they built are still functioning. The pilot area is just south of where I live in Tucson, so they're still in place, but they canceled the project. But that's just one example of what is being described by which you could call the incursion of private sector, the very, you know, pronounced incursion of the private sector into what is being called the border security market. And all the projections, and any of the listeners can go out and just Google market projections around the border security market. The last one I read describes it in a quote-unquote unprecedented state of growth. Unprecedented boom period. That's what it says. And that's globally. That's not just in the United States. So this idea that border security for the research for Border Patrol Nation, I went to trade show after trade show across the United States. And one of the trade shows, the primary trade show around border security is one that takes place every year in Phoenix, Arizona. It's called the Border Security Expo. And there I'm able to usually talk to tons of vendors. It's at the Phoenix Convention Center. You go into this, it's not only a conference that brings in like head honchos or Department of Homeland Security, Border Protection and ICE. It also brings in tons of people from the private sector that are selling their technologies. So you go into the expo area, you look up at the high, and, you know, in a high ceiling center hall, and you'll see like banners coming down from the ceilings from like companies like Boeing and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. You also see, you know, surveillance balloons with high powered cameras hooked underneath, you know, hanging from the ceilings, and you'll see all kinds of different technologies from mini drones to cameras to you name it, it's there. And one of the vendors, you know, I did an extensive interview with, he was trying to sell a video system on a mobile surveillance system to DHS, and this company is a small Tucson-based company actually, and they had been selling their products to the military. But then he went on to say, with some of our wars winding down abroad, we're looking for another market. And then he said, and a lot of us are turning our eyes towards this border security market. So we're looking at some of our equipment that we were selling to the military, and now we're repurposing the equipment for a border surveillance mission. And then he told me at the very end of our conversation a quote that probably explains it all. And he said, "We are bringing, quote unquote, the battlefield to the border." And that seems to be, you know, he said it in its most raw, you know, the rawest way that you could say it. But he is explaining something that just about anyone in that room, including from the big, huge military manufacturers like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, they would probably say the same thing. You know, that, and you know, we're there, the market, the, it's many of these private sector companies are looking for new markets. And so this creates this relationship, the very same relationship. I mean, if Eisenhower, when he was, you know, the famous 1961 farewell speech where he warned against the military-industrial complex, if he were to look at what's going on with the, you know, at the time, I mean, I don't think there was possibly just a chain link fence between the United States and Mexico. He's probably, you know, I just try to imagine after thinking about his farewell speech where he warned against, you know, this kind of relationship, this power relationship between, you know, private sector, the government, and armed forces. And if you were to, like, to hear what he would say about what's going on the border right now with this, which is becoming increasingly profitable for all kinds of major companies.
And then you get the cycle because they have more dollars to spend on lobbying, which is why we always end up in the same direction, more and more border security. The administration has now called for $3.7 billion to address the crisis at the border, the so-called crisis. Some of that is going to humanitarian purposes. Some would go to relieving the backlog in terms of administrative hearings, but some of that would be dedicated to more border security. Folks, we've gone mad here. We have armed yahoos confronting busloads of terrified kids. We have people screaming about an invasion. We've been showering dollars on these defense contractors for 20 years with no appreciable result other than a huge increase in dead migrants in the desert. And many more detainees, I should add, thanks to changes in the law that require the government to hold a lot of the immigrants that it once released pending a hearing. And those changes were in part the result of heavy lobbying from the for-profit prison industry. Meanwhile, we're not addressing the root causes of this wave of migration. In fact, the opposite is true. Let me read just a brief statement by the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, or CISPIS. It reads, and I quote, "For decades, the U.S. has supported brutal military dictatorships in the region, suppressed popular democratic liberation movements, imposed devastating free trade and privatization initiatives, and provided arms and demand for the drug trade." It's madness. Todd Miller, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Folks, the book is Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back. But I'm going to leave you now with Adam Quasman, a schmuck state lawmaker from Arizona.
Adam Quasman was making a speech.
The reason why Lady Justice holds a blindfold over face.
But then the Republican congressional candidate suddenly stopped. He got word a bus was heading down the road and took off for it.
Anything else? Thank you.
It's what Quasman and the Oracle protesters were waiting for, a confrontation with a bus full of migrant children. Quasman tweeted from the scene, "Bus coming in. This is not compassion. This is the abrogation of the rule of law." He included a photo of a yellow school bus.
I was able to actually see some of the children in the buses, in the fear on their faces. This is not compassion.
That fear on the faces of migrant children, Quasman told me he saw in Oracle. There's just one problem. Those weren't migrant children on the yellow school bus. They were YMCA campers from the Marana School District.
Do you know that was a bus with YMCA kids?
They were sad too.
Reporters at the scene saw the children laughing and taking pictures on their iPhones.
I apologize. I didn't know. I was leaving when I saw them.
Quasman later deleted his original tweet, but we found it on Politwhoops, a site that captures politicians' deleted tweets. He did backflips, trying to take back the story.
I said I saw children. Right. I saw children.
But those weren't migrant children.
Those were not migrant children. That's fine.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. stupid bigot is redundant. That audio came to us from KPNX-TV in Arizona. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Phyllis Bennis. Welcome back to the show. From one awful story to the next, I'm joined now by Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project. We go way back. Phyllis Bennis, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Great to be with you.
We're speaking on Friday afternoon, July 18th. What is happening right now in Gaza?
People are being killed. That's what's happening. The Israeli ground assault has moved mostly near the edges. They're not yet in the very center of Gaza, but the ground operation was accompanied from the beginning last night by a serious escalation of shelling from the air and from the Israeli Navy off the coast. So Gazans are being shelled kind of from all sides. There is no safe place in Gaza.
How dense is Gaza in terms of people?
Gaza has about 5,000 people per square kilometer. If you look at lists of countries and territories, the only ones that have a denser population than Gaza are Monaco, Hong Kong, and Macau. So it's one of the most densely populated places on Earth. There are certain refugee camps in Gaza that are more densely populated than Manhattan. But it's not just densely populated. It's incredibly impoverished because it's been destroyed so many times and because it's been under occupation since 1967.
Now, today the U.S. Senate passed a resolution by a vote of 100-0, essentially endorsing the Israeli attack. It makes no mention of Palestinian casualties. It says a phrase that politicians here in the U.S. are fond of saying, that Israel has a right to defend itself. What are your thoughts on this attack being justified as self-defense?
You know, history is determined by when you start the clock. If you start the clock with a Palestinian rocket or a barrage of rockets into Israel, then Israel is responding. And as Obama said today, no nation, this is what apparently he said to Prime Minister Netanyahu, no nation should accept rockets being fired into its borders. One of the problems is, of course, Israel has no declared borders. Gaza apparently should accept rockets being fired into its borders. This is a crazy notion. You know, the people like to say that the current crisis in Gaza began when somebody killed the three young Israelis in the West Bank. Maybe, but what happened a couple of weeks before that? Israeli soldiers killed two Palestinian teenagers. Did that start the crisis? You know, you could pick an event and decide to start the clock at that moment, and that will determine, among other things, who started it, who is simply responding, who is simply having the right to self-defense. Nobody, apparently, in the international community of governments thinks that Palestinians have the right of self-defense. Only Israel has the right of self-defense. And if you look at the casualty disparities, there's been one Israeli civilian and one Israeli soldier killed. And there's been, well, the last I looked, which was a couple of hours ago, it's probably higher already, is that about 265 Palestinians have been killed, of which 80% are civilians, and about 50 are children. Children. Another four children were killed last night on a rooftop. There were four children killed the day before playing on the beach. And Israel said, oh, well, we're sorry. This isn't okay. This isn't something you can just say you're sorry and expect it to go away. These are people's lives that we're talking about, children's lives.
And according to some reports that I've seen, the Israeli soldier who was killed may have been a victim of friendly fire. That may have been Israeli fire also. We had Alex...
It wouldn't be surprising. That was the case in Operation Cast Lead back in 2008 and 2009 when there were 1,400 Palestinians killed and 13 Israelis were killed, of whom 7 were killed by friendly fire.
That's modern warfare. It's so bloody and dangerous that friendly fire is just a fact of it. We had Alex Cain on last week. I asked him if he felt that the political winds were shifting on this issue. He didn't think they were, or not significantly. He's a great guy, very smart, but he's a young guy. He may not remember how vicious it was to take a position critical of Israel's occupation 10 years ago. Now, you took a slightly different view in The Nation. You wrote a piece called Why Opposing the Israel Lobby is No Longer Political Suicide. What was your argument there, Phyllis?
Well, essentially, I'm looking at what has changed in recent years. Clearly, we're not yet able to change the U.S. policy. And like so many other things, that has everything to do with the fact that our so-called democracy is so broken that public opinion really means very little. So I make no claims that the policy has changed. It has not. I mean, when we hear President Obama's words again today, Israel has the right to defend itself, as if this was self-defense. When we see the actions of Congress, they just voted another third of $1 billion of our tax money to be spent directly on the Israeli military. We can't claim that the policy has changed. What has changed dramatically, I think, is the political environment in which that policy takes place. It represents the political opinion of a very rapidly diminishing minority of U.S. citizens. Now, it's hard to know exactly depending obviously on how you ask the poll questions, people still say, yeah, I support Israel in some broad sense. But look at what other polls have indicated. You know, polls, you have to be careful. Polls are a snapshot at best. They're a moment. But look at one particular moment. Look at back at 2010. That was the summer when there was lots of stuff in the media about how Obama was criticizing Israel. Oh, my God, he's throwing Israel under a bus. Oh, my God, he's really pressuring Israel. Well, in fact, he wasn't pressuring Israel. What he was doing was asking a couple of polite questions. Please stop building settlements. Israel said no, and after a few back and forths on that, he stopped asking. That was as far as the pressure went. Now, granted, we had not heard even such a request before, so that was kind of amazing, but it certainly wasn't real pressure. But the press was telling us that Israel's being pressured. This is a very big deal. And in the midst of all that, there was a poll that asked people about Israeli settlement policies. And it gave people two choices. Which sentence best defines how you see the settlements? So sentence number one was, Israelis have the right to build wherever they want. They're building for security reasons. Sentence number two, Israeli settlements are being built on expropriated land, and they should all be torn down and the land returned to its original owners. Now that, in my view, it's accurate in international law terms, but it's a pretty drastic, pretty provocative way of framing the question. But despite how provocative it was, 63% of Democrats chose sentence number two. I thought that was amazing. It doesn't mean it's going to last forever. It doesn't mean it even lasted past that one poll. But the fact that a poll could emerge like that is one indication. The other indication we're seeing in the press. Now, the mainstream press is doing all kinds of things wrong. NBC pulling Ayman Mollahdeen off, by far the best international reporter reporting from Gaza in the mainstream media, pulled off because he was too human when he reported on the killing of the four children on the beach. It happened right outside his hotel. He had been playing soccer with them 10 minutes earlier. And he went on social media, he went on NBC, and described what happened without pulling punches. That was apparently unacceptable. NBC pulled him off the air, and there's campaigns going on now to get him back. But it's not like they're doing everything right. But if you compare it to Operation Cast Lead, for instance, where you didn't have NPR sending their bureau chief to Gaza, you didn't have mainstream media outlets going to Gaza, assuming they needed to be in Gaza. There were a few reporters there. The Israelis couldn't keep everybody out, but it meant that Al Jazeera was there because they had a Gaza team that was living there. The New York Times was in Gaza because it had a young Gazan stringer, Tagrid El-Khoderi, who was doing terrific work. She became a New York Times staffer, but she was from Gaza. She lived in Gaza with her parents. They weren't sending anybody in. This time around, they're all there. They're all watching it. They report it differently. Some don't get it right. But it's an entirely different media environment than we saw over the last 10 years.
Let me ask you this. There are many reports out of Israel, many different accounts of mobs of right-wing extremists beating protesters, beating Palestinians, threatening Western reporters in some cases. There have been instances where these mobs are wearing fascist or neo-fascist garb. And we've had Max Blumenthal on the show to talk about Goliath. Do you think the rise of the extreme right wing in Israel plays some role in the shift that you're talking about?
Oh, I think there's no question that it does. It both plays a role in pushing it, and it's a result of it. You know, if you look at the Israeli cabinet now, it represents the center right, the right, the far right, and the fascist right. That's pretty much it. The polls in Israel are indicating 91% support for what the Israeli military is doing in Gaza. Even the horrific, deliberate torture killing of the young Palestinian man who was killed in Jerusalem by three Israelis, at least, that was something where government officials, Knesset members, and others were going out of their way to disavow it, saying this doesn't reflect us. These are extremists. We're going to call them terrorists. We're going to hold them accountable. No one else has ever been held accountable, we should note, for killing Palestinians. These guys, because it was so horrific, they burned him to death. I mean, the only encouragement that I've had in 3 days was when I read another detailed report, and it indicates that it's possible, not we don't know, but it's possible that he was already unconscious when they set him on fire. That's the best news we've had, that maybe he wasn't aware when he was being burned to death. It's horrific. But the notion that this was somehow the act of an outlier, that this was somehow an extremist move that had no support anywhere and was, you know, outside the pale, simply doesn't fly. There was a member of the Knesset 2 days before that who gave a speech, wrote an article describing how Hamas is not our enemy, the people of Gaza are our enemies, and we have to go after all of them. And she actually said that we need to go after women because otherwise they'll keep giving birth to what she called more little snakes. That was the term she used. It was so reminiscent, Joshua, of the language in the United States during the genocidal wars against the native population in this country, where Indian killing generals talked about the need to kill them all. And one very famously said, "Nits make lice. We need to kill the children because they will grow up." You know, it's that kind of horrific racism that has become mainstream in Israeli society.
But Phyllis, my question, and I wasn't clear, do you think that this growing extremism is shifting the discourse in this country? I mean, you look at the schism between the Obama administration and Netanyahu, but also, you know, real extremists in the government like Avigdor Lieberman. How is that playing a role in the
yes.
somewhat tangible shift we're seeing in the politics of Israel-Palestine?
Yes, I think it absolutely is playing a role, particularly in the Jewish community, where the shift has been perhaps more dramatic than anywhere else. You know, you have a scenario now where AIPAC still has tons of money, more than anybody else, and they use it with abandon. But they can no longer go to members of Congress and not only threaten to use their money to find and fund a new opponent that the member of Congress never even heard of if they don't toe the line on Israel, but they used to also say, and we'll bring you the Jewish votes if you toe the line. They can't say that anymore because they don't have that kind of public support within the Jewish community. That's one of the big differences. The rise of J Street a few years ago broke the taboo that said that only AIPAC can speak for Jews in Washington. Suddenly there was somebody else. Now, I have my differences with J Street. I think they're problematic in a number of ways, but they broke that taboo, and that's been huge. More importantly, you now have an organization like Jewish Voice for Peace, with 150,000 supporters and chapters in 40 cities and college campuses across the country, especially among young Jews. So you have a much more divided Jewish community now, where you have AIPAC on the right, J Street in the center, and JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, on the left. So it's an entirely different political environment, and that has a huge impact on the broader political environment because it changes what is acceptable discourse for people outside the Jewish community. And much of that shift has come partly because people see more what Israel is doing. There's more social media, there's more access to the most graphic descriptions and photographs of what occupation looks like in a more immediate way than there ever was before. But we're also seeing an awareness of the fact that people in Israel are supporting it, and people here are appalled by that. You know, it's not surprising that Jews for so many years were known as the white community that was most likely to be involved in progressive movements, in the civil rights movement, in the Vietnam-era anti-war movement. Jews were disproportionately represented among the white cohort of those movements. That's no longer the case, but what is still true is that many, many Jews in this country still identify with progressive movements on everything other than Israel-Palestine. That's becoming untenable for a lot more of them.
Yes, and there's a generational divide as well. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Phyllis Bennis. She's with the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis, I want to read a few sentences from an editorial in Haaretz. It refers to a speech Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu made, I believe, the Friday before last. I quote, "Netanyahu's comments last Friday were important. There cannot be a situation under any agreement," he declared, "in which we relinquish security control of the territory west of the River Jordan." With those words, explained the Times of Israel editor David Horovitz, a Netanyahu sympathizer, the prime minister was insisting upon ongoing Israeli security oversight inside and at the borders of the West Bank. That sentence, quite simply, spells the end to the notion of Netanyahu consenting to the establishment of a Palestinian state. I have a couple of questions about this. First, is this different than the long-standing expectation that many observers have that an eventual Palestinian state would be a demilitarized state? Is this a new position or just a different way of putting it?
It's slightly new. I think part of the problem is that some of those people who have there's this phrase, you hear it in Washington all the time, everyone knows. Everyone knows what a two-state solution looks like. Everyone knows that the main settlement blocks will be part of a future Israeli state. Everyone knows that Palestine will have to be forcibly demilitarized from outside. Everyone knows that Palestine will not have control of its own borders. Everyone knows that the coastal waters that of Gaza, that the airspace under the ground, that all of that will remain under Israeli control. Everyone knows that, except, excuse me, for the Palestinians, who those few who still think that a two-state solution is possible, actually think that a state means sovereign state, and not just a piece of territory where you have what amount to municipal rights to organize the garbage collection and pay the teachers. That's what we have now, and this time it seemed like Netanyahu was being a bit more upfront about what he's talking about when he says he supports a two-state solution. Many of us never believed that he supported a two-state solution, nor do we believe at this stage that a two-state solution is possible. It has become impossible because of the settlements. There is no longer a Palestine that can be a state. So we have to sort of get past that. That's not really a job for you and I in this country. I'm a Jewish girl from California. I don't think it's up to us to make the call of how many states, you know, one state, two state, red state, blue state. That's not our business. Our business is to make sure that our government supports a policy that is based on international law, human rights, and equality for all. One could imagine such a policy in a two-state arrangement, but not the one that actually has any physical ability to come into existence given what exists on the ground now. You know, one could imagine a situation with two states where one state is based on the borders of 1967, all of the borders of 1967, Israel on the one side and Palestine made up of all of the West Bank, all of Gaza, and all of occupied East Jerusalem, and call that a state and say that everybody in both of those states is equal, no privileging for people who happen to be Jewish, no discrimination against those who happen to not be Jewish or vice versa, and equality between the two states. That is key. Nobody's talking about that because, remember it, everyone knows that Palestine will be disarmed. Nobody's talking about disarming Israel. Nobody's even talking about disarming its illegal nuclear, its dangerous nuclear weapons arsenal, you know, that is destabilizing the entire region. Nobody's talking about that. It's only the Palestinians that are assumed to be preparing to live in a forcibly demilitarized state.
I've long given up on the idea of a negotiated two-state settlement. I mean, as nice as that may be, I think it's time that we face reality. We really need to grapple with the reality of it. We have a de facto one state with very, very difficult living conditions for one population. Phyllis Bennis, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'd also like to thank Todd Miller. You can read my stuff at billmoyers.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can write an email griping about this very show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. Of course, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. Have a terrific week.